groves clothed the slopes. Sergeant Nash and his men fetched the 17 corpses from the bell tower and propped them up in a sitting position against a low wall that marked the edge of the terrace. Lestrange walked along, looking at each in turn. "I thought I told you," he said to Sergeant Nash, "that I particularly did not want anyone interfering with the corpses." Sergeant Nash looked indignant. "I'm sure, sir," he said, "that none of our lads has touched them. But my lord," he said, appealing to Lord Wellington, "there was scarcely a corpse on the battlefield that those Spanish irregulars had not done something to." He expatiated on the various national failings of the Spanish, and concluded that if a man so much as went to sleep where the Spanish could find him, he would be sorry for it when he woke up. Lord Wellington waved impatiently at the man to make him quiet. "I do not see that they are very much mutilated," he said to Strange. "Does it matter if they are?" Strange muttered blackly that he supposed it did not, except that he had to look at them. Indeed, most of the wounds that the Neapolitans bore appeared to have been the ones that killed them, but all of them had been stripped naked, and several had had their fingers cut off, the better to remove their rings. One had been a handsome young man, but his beauty was very much marred now that someone had plucked out his teeth, to make false teeth, and cut off most of his black hair, to make wigs. Strange told a man to fetch a sharp knife and a clean bandage. When the knife was brought, he took off his coat and rolled up the sleeve of his shirt. Then he began muttering to himself in Latin. He next made a long, deep cut in his arm, and when he had got a good strong spurt of blood, he let it splash over the heads of the corpses, taking care to anoint the eyes, tongue, and nostrils of each. After a moment, the first corpse roused itself. There was a horrible, rasping sound, as its dried-out lungs filled with air, and its limbs shook in a way that was very dreadful to behold. Then, one by one, the corpses revived, and began to speak in a guttural language which contained a much higher proportion of screams than any language known to the onlookers. Even Wellington looked a little pale. Only Strange continued, apparently without emotion. "Dear God," cried Fitzroy Somerset, "what language is that?"
"I believe it is one of the dialects of hell," said Strange.
"Is it indeed?" said Somerset. "Well, that is remarkable."
"They have learnt it very quickly," said Lord Wellington. "They have only been dead 3 days."
He approved of people doing things promptly and in a business-like fashion.
"But do you speak this language?" he asked Strange.
No, my lord."
"Then how are we to talk to them?"
For answer, Strange grasped the head of the first corpse, pulled open its jabbering jaws, and spat inside its mouth. Instantly, it began to speak in its native earthly language, a thick Neapolitan dialect of Italian, which to most people was quite as impenetrable and almost as horrible as the language it had been speaking before. It had the advantage, however, of being perfectly comprehensible to Captain White. With Captain White's help, Major Grant and Colonel Delancey interrogated the dead Neapolitans, and were highly pleased by the answers they returned. Being dead, the Neapolitans were infinitely more anxious to please their questioners than any living informer could have been. It seemed that shortly before their deaths at the Battle of Salamanca, these wretches had each received a secret message from their countrymen hidden in the woods, informing them of the capture of the cannon and telling them to make their way to a village a few leagues north of the city of Salamanca, from where they could easily be able to find the wood by following secret signs chalked on trees and boulders. Major Grant took a small detachment of cavalry, and within a few days he returned with both guns and deserters. Wellington was delighted. Unfortunately, Strange was entirely unable to discover the spell for sending the dead Neapolitans back to their bitter sleep. Footnote 4. To end the lives of the corpses, you cut out their eyes, tongues, and hearts. He made several attempts, but these had very little effect, except that once he made all 17 corpses suddenly shoot up until they were 20 feet tall and strangely transparent, like huge watercolor paintings of themselves down on thin muslin banners. When Strange had returned them to their normal size, the problem of what should be done with them remained. At first, they were placed with the other French prisoners, but the other prisoners protested loudly about being confined with such shambling, shuffling horrors.
And really, observed Lord Wellington, as he eyed the corpses with distaste, one cannot blame them.
So when the prisoners were sent back to England, the dead Neapolitans remained with the army. All that summer, they travelled in a bullock cart, and on Lord Wellington's orders, they were shackled. The shackles were intended to restrict their movements and keep them in one place. But the dead Neapolitans were not afraid of pain. Indeed, they did not seem to feel it. So it was very little trouble to them to extricate themselves from their shackles, sometimes leaving pieces of themselves behind. As soon as they were free, they would go in search of Strange and begin pleading with him in the most pitiful manner imaginable to restore them to the fullness of life. They had seen hell and were not anxious to return there. In Madrid, the Spanish artist Francisco Goya made a sketch in red chalk of Jonathan Strange, surrounded by the dead Neapolitans. In the picture, Strange is seated on the ground. His gaze is cast down, and his arms hang limp at his sides, and his whole attitude speaks of helplessness and despair. The Neapolitans crowd around him. Some are regarding him hungrily. Others have expressions of supplication on their faces. One is putting out a tentative finger to stroke the back of his hair. It is, needless to say, quite different from any other portrait of Strange. On the 25th of August, Lord Wellington gave an order for the dead Neapolitans to be destroyed. Footnote 5. Concerning the dead Italian soldiers, I can only say that we greatly regretted such cruelty to men who had already suffered a great deal, but we were obliged to act as we did. They could not be persuaded to leave the magician alone. If they had not killed him, then they would have certainly driven him mad. We were obliged to set two men to watch him while he slept, to keep the dead men from touching him and waking him up. They had been so battered about since their deaths. They were not, poor fellows, a sight anyone wished to see upon waking. In the end, we made a bonfire and threw them on it. Lord Fitzroy Somerset to his brother, the 2nd of September, 1812. Strange was in some anxiety lest Mr. Norrell get to hear of the magic he had done at the ruined church at Flores de Avila. He made no mention of it in his own letters, and he begged Lord Wellington to leave it out of his dispatches. "Well, very well," said his lordship. Lord Wellington was not in any case particularly fond of writing about magic. He disliked having to deal with anything he did not understand extremely well. "But it will do very little good," he pointed out. "Every man that has written a letter home in the last 5 days will have given his friends a very full account of it." "I know," said Strange uncomfortably, "but the men always exaggerate what I do, and perhaps by the time people in England have made allowances for the usual embellishments, it will not appear so very remarkable. They will merely imagine that I healed some Neapolitans that were wounded, or something of that sort." The raising of the 17 dead Neapolitans was a good example of the sort of problem faced by Strange in the latter half of the war. Like the ministers before him, Lord Wellington was becoming more accustomed to using magic to achieve his ends, and he demanded increasingly elaborate spells from his magician. However, unlike the ministers, Wellington had very little time or inclination for listening to long explanations of why a thing was not possible. After all, he regularly demanded the impossible of his engineers, his generals, and his officers, and he saw no reason to make an exception of his magician. "Find another way," was all he would say, as Strange tried to explain that such and such a piece of magic had not been attempted since 1302, or that the spell had been lost, or that it had never existed in the first place. As in the early days of his magicianship, before he had met Norrell, Strange was obliged to invent most of the magic he did, working from general principles and half-remembered stories from old books. In the early summer of 1813, Strange again performed a sort of magic the like of which had not been done since the days of the Raven King. He moved a river. It happened like this. The war that summer was going well, and everything Lord Wellington did was crowned with success. However, it so happened that one particular morning in June, the French found themselves in a more advantageous position than had been the case for some time. His lordship and the other generals immediately gathered together to discuss what could be done to correct this highly undesirable situation. Strange was summoned to join them in Lord Wellington's tent. He found them gathered round a table upon which was spread a large map. His lordship was in really excellent spirits that summer, and he greeted Strange almost affectionately. "Ah, Merlin, there you are. Here is our problem.
We are on this side of the river, and the French are on the other side, and it would suit me much better if the positions were reversed.
One of the generals began to explain that if they marched the army west here, and then built a bridge across the river here, and then engaged the French here,
it will take too long, declared Lord Wellington. Far too long. Well, then, could not you arrange for the army to grow wings and fly over the French? Could you do that, do you think?
His lordship was perhaps half-joking, but only half.
It's only a matter of supplying each man with a little pair of wings. Take Captain Macpherson, for example, he said, eyeing an enormous Scotsman. I've a great fancy to see Macpherson sprout wings and flutter about.
Strange regarded Captain Macpherson thoughtfully.
No, he said at last. But I would be grateful, my lord, if you would permit me to borrow him and the map for an hour or two.
Strange and Captain Macpherson peered at the map for some time, and then Strange went back to Lord Wellington and said that it would take too long for every man in the army to sprout wings, but it would take no time at all to move the river, and would that do?
At the moment, said Strange, the river flows south here and then twists northwards here. If, upon the other hand, it flowed north instead of south, and twisted southwards here, then, you see, we would be on the north bank, and the French on the south.
Oh, said his lordship. Very well.
The new position of the river so baffled the French that several French companies, when ordered to march north, went in entirely the wrong direction, so convinced were they that the direction away from the river must be north. These particular companies were never seen again. And so it was widely supposed that they had been killed by the Spanish guerrilleros. Lord Wellington later remarked cheerfully to General Picton that there was nothing so wearying for troops and horses as constant marching about, and that in future he thought it would be better to keep them all standing still while Mr. Strange moved Spain about like a carpet beneath their feet. Meanwhile, the Spanish Regency Council in Cadiz became rather alarmed at this development, and began to wonder whether, when they finally regained their country from the French, they would recognize it. They complained to the Foreign Secretary, which many people thought ungrateful. The Foreign Secretary persuaded Strange to write the Regency Council a letter, promising that after the war he would replace the river in its original position, and also anything else which Lord Wellington required to be moved during the prosecution of the war. Among the many things which Strange moved were a wood of olive trees and pines in Navarra, Footnote 6. Colonel Vickery had reconnoitred the wood and discovered it to be full of French soldiers waiting to shoot at the British army. His officers were just discussing what to do about it when Lord Wellington rode up.
We could go around it, I suppose, said Wellington, but that will take time, and I'm in a hurry. Where is the magician?
Someone went and fetched Strange.
Mr. Strange, said Lord Wellington, I can scarcely believe that it will be much trouble to you to move these trees. A great deal less, I am sure, than to make 4,000 men walk 7 miles out of their way. Move the wood, if you please.
So Strange did as he was asked, and moved the wood to the opposite side of the valley. The French soldiers were left cowering on a barren hillside, and very quickly surrendered to the British. The city of Pamplona, footnote 7. Owing to a mistake in Wellington's maps of Spain, the city of Pamplona was not exactly where the British had supposed it to be. Wellington was deeply disappointed when, after the army had marched 20 miles in one day, they did not reach Pamplona, which was discovered to be 10 miles further north. After swift discussion of the problem, it was found to be more convenient to have Mr. Strange move the city rather than change all the maps. And two churches in the town of Saint-Jean-de-Luz in France. Footnote 8. The churches in Saint-Jean-de-Luz were something of an embarrassment, and there was no reason whatsoever to move them. The fact of the matter was that one Sunday morning, Strange was drinking brandy for breakfast at a hotel in Saint-Jean-de-Luz with three captains and two lieutenants of the 16th Light Dragoons. He was explaining to these gentlemen the theory behind the magical transportation of various objects. It was an entirely futile undertaking. They would not have understood him very well had they been sober, and neither they nor Strange had been entirely sober for 2 days. By way of an illustration, Strange swapped the positions of the two churches, with the congregation still inside them. He fully intended to change them round again before the people came out, but shortly afterwards he was called away to a game of billiards, and never thought of it again. Indeed, despite Strange's many assurances,
He never found the time or inclination to replace river, wood, city, or indeed anything at all in its original.